Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew would like to once again thank you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. This is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Well, folks, here we are again. We are just plugging along here through the month of July. It's still young, so just sit tight and hang with us if you want to keep enjoying those OTR surprises that we do so well. Allow me to introduce the first presenter for our split shift program here tonight. Deep from the heart of Texas, that real-life cowboy Daniel Vigil. Yep, he's back at it again, doing what he does best, which he seems to enjoy very, very much, and that is hooking you guys up with the highest quality OTR that there is. So, if everyone could just please sit back, grab those snacks and drinks, and enjoy the program. Daniel, the microphone is yours.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, and welcome to another July edition of Michael's Saturday Surprise. If you are astonished to find me back again so soon, I must admit, so am I. However, you're always welcome to closet yourself with me in Daniel's Den for an evening of old-time radio entertainment. And tonight proves no exception. If you've had a chance to listen to my portion of last week's MSS Halloween in July, you'll remember, or perhaps not, that I presented an Inner Sanctum mystery, which involved, among other things, people being shipwrecked at sea. Tonight's program, called The Wreck of the Maid of Athens, is from Suspense. It was broadcast on November 30th, 1953, and also involves people being shipwrecked at sea.
Autolite and its 98,000 dealers bring you Miss Agnes Moorhead in tonight's presentation of Suspense.
Tonight, Autolite presents the first radio adaptation of one of the most amazing human documents ever written, the personal diary of Emily Wooldridge, which she called The Wreck of the Maid of Athens. Our star, the first lady of suspense, Miss Agnes Moorhead.
Hi, Hap. Buying a magazine, I see.
Yes, sir, Harlow.
Well, why not take this one?
Oh, no, thanks. Everyone to his own taste, you know, Harlow.
In buying magazines, yes, Hap. But in replacing electrical system parts for your car, definitely no.
Hmm?
Well, for example, many leading makes of our finest cars have Autolite electrical systems as original equipment, right?
Right.
But if replacements are needed, do the owners of those Autolite-equipped cars insist on Autolite original service parts? Exactly the same as those specified by the car manufacturer?
Well, if they don't, they're sure taking a big chance with a big investment, Harlow.
They sure are, Hap, because Autolite original service parts meet the electrical system specifications of the car manufacturers, and they know what's best for their cars. So, friends, insist on and be sure you get only Autolite original service parts for your Autolite-equipped car. See your car dealer or your dealer handling Autolite original service parts. And remember, from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
And now, Autolite presents Emily Wooldridge's The Wreck of the Maid of Athens, starring Miss Agnes Moorhead, hoping once again to keep you in suspense. Eighty-four years ago tonight, there sailed from the port of London the brigantine Maid of Athens. 60-some days later, off the cold southern tip of South America, the ship was afire and sinking in heavy seas. Aboard her, along with the necessary officers and crew, was the wife of the master, Captain Richard Wooldridge. Her name was Emily, and this is her story.
mate's overside, sir. He was trying to free the port lifeboats. We can't go after him. Those boats are jammed. We'll never use them.
Very well. Tell the rest of the men to come here. We'll have to abandon ship as quickly as possible.
Perhaps the most terrible thing of all was the fact that there wasn't room in the lifeboats for all the men. Always in my memory will live the picture of those who fought to live and who died so hopelessly in those cold seas. It was a scene of fearful desolation. Great waves seemed to swallow in their troughs our two surviving lifeboats. And when we were lifted to their crest, the sight of the burning ship met our eyes. The gallant Maid of Athens. She seemed to me the loneliest thing I'd ever seen as we deserted her. Looking the other way by the grace of Providence, we could see a low fringe of land on the horizon. My husband took this to be the island of San Carlo and perhaps our salvation. But when we arrived near the shore, we found that instead of safety, we had run on even greater danger in the heavy surf that pounded the rocky island. To try to land through it was a fatal risk, as was proved later, but my husband had no other choice than to order the boats into it.
Stern around! The second boat there! Stern around! Stern ashore! Keep your bows into the surf! Get alongside us and do as we do! Steady now! Keep us standing properly! On the ready now! All right now, follow it in!
Except for the vision of a wave towering over us, high as a mountain and falling on us, I have no memory of coming ashore. As though awaking, no, not quite awaking, from a nightmare, I saw our boat overturned on a tiny strip of sand. I saw my husband and the men who had survived the landing, and I saw the bodies of those from the second boat who had not. My husband was pulling the last of these from the angry surf, and he was bending over me where I lay.
Are you all right, my dear?
Yes. And you?
I'm quite all right. But the poor devils in the other boat.
Oh, yes, I know.
Besides us, there are only four left now. Hayward, Oates, Roberts, and old Rawson. There was nothing I could do to save the others.
Of course there wasn't. Everyone knows you did everything you could do.
Oh, I hope so. Can you stand up?
Yes, I think I... Come on. Oh, Dick, do the rest of us have a chance?
A very good chance. Come along. Oh. We'll go further up the shore and build a shelter of some sort. It's a nasty cold wind.
Hey, Captain!
Yes, Lawson.
He and the others have been talking. We'd like a word with you, if you don't mind.
Oh, of course. What is it?
We've lost a number of our chums, as you well know.
Oh, I do know, Lawson. I'm terribly sorry.
Not much good being sorry, is it? Not going to help any of the poor blokes, is it?
Well, just what do you mean, Lawson? I feel our loss is greatly, if not greater than you do. Now, what do you mean?
The way we've been talking, easy to say how sorry you are after the damage is done, but what we want to know is, why wasn't something done to prevent it from happening?
I don't think I quite understand you. Every precaution was taken in London. The cargo and the loading was well supervised. You all know that.
Then why did the ship catch fire?
I don't know.
Nobody said nothing to us about a cargo that would catch fire.
It was not a dangerous cargo, Hayward.
Then why did it catch fire?
I've told you I don't know. Under given circumstances, the most peaceful voyage can go wrong.
What circumstances, Captain?
It's only decent to place the blame when you've lost as many chums as we have. A fine lot they were.
Now listen to me, men. Talk like this won't do any good. I'll admit we've had more than our share of bad luck.
We'll say aye to that.
But we six were spared. And if we are to survive, we've got to work together.
There won't be any more than survival on this filthy island. We haven't got food stores for a week, and our waiter doesn't see a ship once a year.
Well, we won't wait to be found by a ship. Now, the mainland of South America is a bit more than 300 miles west. I have the navigational instruments to get us there. If we can repair the boat.
Oh, maybe it's not so bad as you thought it was, Lawson.
It's bad enough. We'll have to be lucky to live to tell of it.
It won't be easy, but it is possible. And I can't stress the importance of speed strongly enough. There are two reasons. One is scarcity of food. The other is more important. We're approaching the storm season in these latitudes. And when it arrives, the gales are almost constant.
Aye. We're having our share of bad fortune. That's a fact.
We shall be all right if we work quickly. If we can repair the boat in, say, 4 days and launch it without accident, I have every confidence that we'll be on our way to safety and home.
Darkness fell as Lawson and the others buried the dead. A thick fog settled on the island. And in spite of exhaustion, the dampness and cold made sleep out of the question. We spent the night huddled over fires, one for the crew and one for my husband and me. We were separated from the men by only a few paces, and although nothing further was said, there was a tension between the two groups. The next morning, my husband set the men to work on the boat where her planks had been battered on the rocks, and he set out to search the island, hoping to find a beach better suited to launching through the surf. No sooner had he disappeared than Lawson, a sullen, unpleasant man from the start of the voyage, walked toward me, and behind I could see the other men leaving their work to follow him.
I trust you spent the night counting your blessings, Mrs. Wooldridge.
Why, I'm thankful to be alive, as we all should be.
And did you give a thought to the poor boys, what went down? And then we buried?
Of course. My husband told you men to repair the boat. Why aren't you doing it?
We want you to hear what we have to say.
But what do you want with me? What is it?
The day you stepped aboard in London, I said there was going to be trouble. I told the boys, the ones that's dead and gone now, a woman at sea is a deadly thing. I told them.
We didn't half believe him then, but we do now.
But you can't believe it. There's no truth in it. It's only a superstition.
I am one with some meaning behind it. Do you know the history of the Maid of Athens? Yeah, well, I do. 42 voyages she had. 42. Not a sea she hadn't crossed through fair weather and foul. And she'd never carried a woman until you came aboard.
Well, what do you say to that?
Well, it doesn't mean anything.
It does. We got more proof on our side than you have on yours. We saw the ship go down.
It isn't proof.
Listen to this. I've sailed for 32 years with good fortune all the way. That is, until this trip.
How do you answer that?
There is no answer.
But then you admit that you're the cause of the trouble.
I do not. You're acting like children.
Children, you say? You should be speaking of the poor fatherless children of them that went down, made orphans by a fire that nobody can explain. Maybe you can.
Well, now, the rest of you, listen to me. There's no one to blame. When you're carrying cotton, and if it gets damp, sometimes the weight of it causes pressure and friction and fires start. It's happened before.
When?
I don't know, but it does happen. My husband told me it did.
Any of you chums ever hear of anything like that? A fire starting because cotton is wet?
In 12 years at sea, I never did.
It happened because a woman at sea is a deadly thing.
You've caused it. There's no doubt of it.
That's not true.
Can you prove that it's not?
Well, one needs facts to disprove something, and you accuse me without facts.
What you mean is you can't prove we're wrong. I would take that as your confession. Hey, lads?
It is not. It is not. I have nothing to confess.
You brought us this trouble, and we all know it. There's nothing you can say to change our minds. And that goes for what you might say for your husband, too. Good day, Mrs. Wooldridge. Come on, lads.
Quite obviously, there was an unspoken threat in their words. And although I hoped that I had maintained my composure in front of them, I was frightened. Considering the problems already weighing upon my husband, it was my play to keep this fear to myself. But when he returned, my will weakened, and I told him about it.
My dear, you mustn't let it trouble you. As you told them, they are like children. What they think today will be forgotten tomorrow.
But I can't forget their faces. They hated me.
Oh, no, no. They only thought that they did. Well, they must have something to hate because of the situation we're in. Remember, before it was me they blamed?
I suppose you're right. I suppose I'm silly to be frightened, but... Oh, please, Dick, don't leave me alone with them again.
I hope I won't have to. But if I do mind to have courage, you know that although they are simple in their logic, they are good seamen, and they're very important to us.
His words did give me courage. The men were important to him as seamen. When he said that, I realized that he was more important to them because he was the only one who could set us on a course that would take us to safety. He was the only one who could navigate. With his importance to them, surely the men would do nothing to me. Well, that is what I hopefully thought. But I could not forget the expressions of hate on the faces of the four men as I stood before them.
Autolite is bringing you Miss Agnes Moorhead in Emily Wooldridge's The Wreck of the Maid of Athens. Tonight's presentation in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Say, Hap, if a reader asked for a sports magazine, would he let the man substitute detective stories?
Well, of course not, Harlow.
Yet many magazine readers will stand for substitute parts in the vital electrical system of their Autolite-equipped cars.
But why, Harlow?
Well, Hap, I guess it's because readers can easily see what's inside the cover of a magazine, but not what's under the hood of the car.
But it's simple, Harlow. Just insist on Autolite original service parts for your Autolite-equipped car. And then you can't go wrong.
Right you are, Hap. Autolite original service parts meet the exact specifications of leading car manufacturers who specify Autolite electrical systems as original equipment. That means they fit and work as a balanced team with the rest of the electrical system to give you the smoothest performance money can buy.
You don't take substitutes in magazines, so why take them for your car?
Yes, friends, be sure you get what's best for your Autolite-equipped car. See your car dealer or your dealer handling Autolite original service parts. And remember, from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage Miss Agnes Moorhead in Elliot Lewis's production of Emily Wooldridge's The Wreck of the Maid of Athens. A true story, well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Thinking back to my meeting with Lawson and the men, it was impossible for me to understand how they could be so blind. But when one remembers the witchcraft trials in Salem and the burning of witches in Europe, then one realizes that humans have often used demons and superstitions when no reasonable cause for a situation can be found. As the work on the boat continued, it became my responsibility to add to our meager larder. With some rough hooks fashioned by my husband and some stout cordage secured to the rocks, I fished. Although I checked these set lines often, even at night when sleep was impossible, the results were disappointing. I thought it possible that the attitudes of the men would soften toward me because of my efforts to better conditions, but there were no indications that this change was taking place, only dark, accusing looks. One, Hayward, the youngest of them, seemed less hateful than the others. He averted his eyes when I looked at him. That evening of the second day, Lawson paid a visit on my husband. A visit that made my fears all the more real.
Top of the evening to you, Captain.
Thank you, Lawson.
Mrs. Wooldridge.
Good evening.
Well, the top of the evening ain't worth anything on this rotten wet island. I hope you don't mind my coming, sir.
Of course not, Lawson. What is it?
Are you satisfied with the way the work is going, sir?
Yes, I am more than satisfied. To be quite honest, considering the mood you men were in the day we arrived, I expected trouble. I'm thankful that there hasn't been any.
A bit upset we were losing all those chums. But it's survival of the fittest, I suppose. When do you think we'll be ready to leave?
I should say it will depend on the surf. Oh, the boat should be fit day after tomorrow. But if the surf is heavy, we won't be able to launch safely here, and we'll have to move to the other beach. Well, that'll take a day.
The fourth day, then?
Yes, I should say so, barring any trouble, that is.
Yes, sir. Now, I wouldn't want you to think that I'm expecting anything bad to happen, sir. It was the boys that asked me to talk to you about this.
About what?
The way they feel, sir. Well, we're all in this together, everybody equal, taking the same chances.
Yes, that's right.
Going through that surf and trying to make the crossing to the mainland. Anything might happen to any one of us.
Yes, that's true, too.
Well, what the boys mean, sir, is that right now everybody's not quite equal. And that's because you're the only one who can keep us on course once we start.
I suppose I am, yes.
Yeah. Well, now, I repeat, we aren't looking for anything bad to happen, but suppose it did to you. Then where would the rest of us be? What with 300 miles of ocean to cross and none of us knowing how to keep us on a course?
I see. You want me to teach you navigation?
No.
Emily.
Not just me, sir. All of us.
No, don't do it.
What's come over you, my dear?
Well, they're up to something.
I don't know what's upset you, Mrs. Wooldridge. We're thinking of you, too. Well, the captain wouldn't want you to drift about until you died of thirst in case something happens to him. Right, sir?
Well, that's quite right. But I'll tell you what upset Mrs. Wooldridge. Perhaps we can straighten it out. You told her she was to blame for our misfortune, Millie, because she was aboard. It's a ridiculous thing for you to say, and it frightened her.
Well, some of the chums got to talking about it, and they got a bit excited.
It wasn't the other men. It was you.
I only said what they told me to, Mrs. Wooldridge, and I'm sorry that I did.
There been any more conversation about it?
Oh, no, sir, no. The only thing they talk about now is getting home. I don't suppose we're much for brains, sir, but do you think we could learn navigation?
Oh, yes. At least enough to reach the coast. Then one could feel his way until he reached a port. We'll have the first lesson tonight.
Thank you, sir. The boys will be pleased to hear this.
I'll be with you in a moment, then.
Night, Mrs. Wooldridge.
Oh, please, Dick. Please don't teach them. If you do, you won't be important to them any longer. They'll be in control. I know that that's what they want. They're evil men. They're capable of anything. What have they left us here?
Now, Emily, stop it. Stop it. Oh, in a situation like this, we must be realistic. It's for the good of all that the men should learn to navigate.
My husband returned an hour later, quite pleased with the spirit of the men and the progress they had made during their first lesson. I tried to match his confidence with my own, but the next day that became impossible. There was no mistaking the hate for me in the faces of the men when my husband was not present. But he had no chance to realize this because the expressions changed when he appeared. The men took on a rough good humor and an enthusiasm for their work and the future that completely beguiled him. At times I doubted my reason, but at others I was sure that I didn't imagine this purposeful change of attitude. Then during the afternoon, I was able to speak with Hayward, the one I hoped felt less strongly toward me. He was on his way to the spring that supplied our water when I was able to meet him alone.
Mrs. Wooldridge! What are you doing here?
I wanted to talk to you.
I don't want to talk to you. I've got nothing to say.
Why did Lawson lie to my husband and me?
I don't know what you mean.
He told us last night that you men didn't blame me for what happened.
Well, we don't.
That you realize how ridiculous the things were that you said to me the first day. That I was the cause...
That's right.
But then why do you hate me?
Hate you? We don't, Mrs. Wooldridge.
The expressions on your faces when my husband isn't there couldn't mean anything else. What is it? What are you thinking?
You must be mistaken, Mrs. Wooldridge. All we talk about is getting home.
That's what Lawson told you to say if you had to talk to me, isn't it?
I don't know what you mean.
He said the same thing last night in the same words. But he was lying, wasn't he, just like you are?
You've got no reason to say that, Mrs. Wooldridge. I don't know what we'd want to lie about.
About what your plans are.
Plans? Why, they want to get home as quick as we can. Isn't that what you plan?
You're lying to me.
But, Mrs. Wooldridge, why should you say that?
That's not what you're thinking. What are your plans?
What I told you. To go home.
You're lying to me. I can tell from your face.
It's been a trying experience, Mrs. Wooldridge. Perhaps your mind is playing tricks. I don't know what else could upset you like this.
Final repairs on the boat were completed that day, and all of the next was consumed in moving it to the safer beach. The surf was not as high as the shore was protected by a curve of reef from which I cast my set lines. The crashing waves caused terrible currents, and the frightening prospect of maneuvering a boat through them was real enough to keep my mind clear of my other fears, which seemed to have no basis at the moment. At nightfall, I was huddled close to our fire as my husband awoke from a short nap.
Oh. How long have I slept?
No more than an hour.
Oh. Seemed like days. I will sleep days once I get into a bed again. What luxury that'll be, eh?
Oh, I hope everything will be all right tomorrow and with the crossing.
No reason it shouldn't be. A stout boat, we're with the prevailing winds.
Oh, you don't have to make it sound easy for me, you know. Just tell me if there's a good chance of reaching safety.
There's a very good chance, Emily.
Oh.
And I must say that I'm happy to see your mood improved. Morale will be most important when we're at sea.
Well, I'll help the best I can.
I know you will, my dear.
Okay.
Oh, Lawson, yes, what is it?
I hope you don't mind. The boys are a bit uneasy tonight. They asked me to come.
Anything wrong?
Nothing special, sir. They wonder if you could tell them where we'll land. Roughly, that is. But they wanted me to ask if you'd talk to them for a bit.
Oh, I suppose they are uneasy, yes. I'll have a word with them.
Oh, they'd like that, sir. You know, myself, I'm not troubled. I'd say it's in the lap of the gods, so while you go to see them, I think I'll have a look at the beach again, see how the surf is running.
I think that'd be a good idea. Let me know how the currents are crossing, will you?
Aye, sir.
Well, I'll be back in a few minutes.
No, Emily. No, don't leave.
Only a few moments, Emily, dear. Now, you try to rest.
All right, Mrs. Wooldridge.
What are you going to do?
Nothing, Mrs. Wooldridge. But you, it's time to tend your set lines out on the surf. I think I'll go with you in case you have an accident on those slippery rocks in the dark.
No, I'm going to do it in the morning.
You've done it before at night. You've killed enough men, and now it's an eye for an eye.
I haven't killed anybody. You're insane. My husband...
You'll kill him if you call for him. The boys are ready to take care of him if you do. And we don't need him anymore.
Oh, I knew.
It's all up to you, Mrs. Wooldridge. Ain't fair of you to risk us all when a slip off the reef will save us.
I won't shout.
Come along, then. We've seen what a woman at sea brings about, but it won't happen again in the small boat.
Do you have to do this? Won't you admit that you're wrong, that superstitions are baseless, and that you've nothing to fear about my going with you?
We've seen what happens, and what you see is proof. We'll talk no more about it.
No, no, you can't do
this. Listen, Captain, let her go. It's all right, darling. Everything's all right. But thank heaven the other men were more human than Lawson. They let him lead them until tonight. But they couldn't justify murder and told me what he planned to do.
After 3 weeks, the five survivors of the Maid of Athens reached the port of Stanley in the Falklands. As Emily Wooldridge stated it in her chronicle, in time to hear of the death of Charles Dickens, a sorrowful landfall after all our trials. Suspense. Presented by Autolite, tonight's star, Miss Agnes Moorhead.
This is Harlow Wilcox speaking for Autolite, the world's largest independent manufacturer of automotive electrical equipment. In 28 plants from coast to coast, Autolite makes over 400 products for cars, trucks, tractors, planes, boats, and industry. These products include bumpers, die castings, industrial thermometers, and batteries, such as the famous Autolite Stayfull, ignition-engineered Autolite spark plugs, both standard and resistor types, voltage regulators, wire and battery cable, Autolite bullseye sealed beam units, and Autolite original service parts for all Autolite electrical systems. Autolite is proud to serve the greatest names in the industry. So, from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
Next week, we bring to life one of the most famous detectives in literature as we dramatize E.C. Bentley's classic novel of deduction, Trent's Last Case. Our star, Mr. Ronald Coleman. That's next week on Suspense. Suspense is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis, with music composed by Lucian Morawick and conducted by Lud Gluskin. Emily Wooldridge's The Wreck of the Maid of Athens was adapted for Suspense by Gil Dowd. In tonight's story, Joseph Kearns was heard as Captain Wooldridge and Ben Wright as Lawson. Featured in the cast were Larry Thor, Richard Peel, and Jack Crucian.
Agnes Moorhead may soon be seen in the Universal International Picture Magnificent Obsession.
And remember, next week, Mr. Ronald Coleman in Trent's Last Case.
You can buy Autolite original service parts, Autolite standard or resistor type spark plugs, and Autolite stay full batteries at your neighborhood Autolite dealers. Switch to Autolite. Good night.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
What you just heard was an episode of Suspense, entitled The Wreck of the Maid of Athens, and broadcast on November 30th, 1953. I've got to hand it to that crew. They were happy enough to find a strong leader among them, but once told the captain's wife would have to be murdered, they suddenly developed a conscience. Well, whatever the reason, at least Miss Agnes Moorhead didn't have to suffer the drama and mess of having to die in a suspense play, like she did in Sorry, Wrong Number. Speaking of that, I wonder if ever in her life she received a phone call like this.
Operator, I'd like to make a collect call, please. First name, Bob. Last name is... Dr. David. We ought a baby eats a boy.
Hello?
Collect call for Mr. Bob. We ought a baby eats a boy.
Sorry, wrong number.
Who's that, dear?
Bob. They had a baby. It's a boy.
Oh.
Don't cheat the phone company. Save money the legal way. Call GEICO. A 15-minute call could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Yes, oh yes, indeed. That was an early GEICO commercial, broadcast only on TV. But as I have demonstrated here, it would have done just as well on radio. So that I'm not accused of cheating anyone out of their fair share of time, I'm going to bring someone in now to close Daniel's Den and introduce the next presenter, who I must remember to thank for allowing me to share this part of his MSS program. Luis, come and let us know what's in store during our next half hour, as I'm sure right now we could all use a break.
Okay, Dan, thanks a lot, and I will take it from here for just a moment. Okay, folks, we have just reached the intermission portion of our split shift program here tonight. So if there's anything that you guys need to do to freshen up, please take the time to do it now while we get things set up for the bottom half of the program here tonight. So, without any further delays, I am going to introduce the next presenter. And he just so happens to be the director of MSS. Yep, you might have guessed, the California kid, Miguel Amaro. He's doing, you know, those things that he does whenever we can drag him out from his office and get him into the studio. So why don't we all just sit back and enjoy the OTR stylings of the MSS director here. Miguel, the microphone is yours.
Thanks, Luis. Hi, everybody. Welcome to my half of Michael's Saturday Surprise for this Saturday. Would like to thank the previous presenter for coming on my show today. Gonna end things with The Lone Ranger, January 25th, 1952, Unwelcome Visitors.
I'm still there!
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver! The Lone Ranger! Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Oh, Silver! Let's go, big fellow!
Dan Reed, teenage nephew of the Lone Ranger, returned from a trip to the nearby town of Rock Point and pulled to a stop hurriedly at the camp he shared in the hills with the Lone Ranger and Tonto.
Ho, Victor, ho, 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 steady, boy.
Something wrong, Dan?
You ride Victor plenty fast. Him all leather, Dan.
I saw the white mask outlaw. He and his men held up the bank in Rock Point.
Are you sure it was the white mask outlaw?
Yes, sir.
Him killer we come here to find.
I had a close look at him.
Tell us what happened.
When I arrived in town, I left Victor at the hitch rack. That's just beside the watering trough outside the bank.
Go on.
I went across the street to the store. When I came out, I went back to where Victor was waiting.
Yes?
I was putting the packages into my saddlebag when it happened. Easy, Victor. Steady, boy. Steady. That'll hold all right. Now. Man running from the bank. I'll hide beside the watering trough. Oh, golly, they're coming right this way.
Get your ropes in quick. Oh, no, this dirty coyote snicked my wrist. Hit Leatherman.
Hey, get up there.
Bullets were hitting the dirt all around me. I was afraid I'd be shot.
Then you might have been killed.
That right?
The watering trough protected me. Luckily, they didn't hit Victor.
Yes, it is lucky.
The leader of the crooks, the man who wears the white mask, almost stepped on my hand as he mounted.
Oh.
I had a close look at him, too. I even saw the streak where the bullet grazed his right wrist.
Did you tell the sheriff about the bullet mark?
Yes, sir. When I crawled out from alongside the watering trough, the sheriff ran over to see if I'd been hurt. I told him what I saw, and he and a posse left town to trail the crooks.
I see. Otto, go toward town and try to pick up the trail of those crooks. Dan, you stay here in camp until we return. Well, let's get the horses, Otto.
The White Mask outlaw, known to his men as Mel, rode with his followers to the Pecos River. There they separated and rode off in pairs. Meanwhile, Dan Reed waited till after sundown for the Lone Ranger and Tonto to return to camp. Finally, the boy rolled into his blanket and lay down to rest. A full moon had risen, and its bright light made everything plainly discernible for some distance. Dan dozed a while. Then he was suddenly startled by a warning whinny from his horse, Victor.
Victor seems to be giving a warning. What is it, Victor?
When his young master approached, Victor raised his magnificent head, holding it high. Then he stood motionless, gazing expectantly up trail. Dan realized Victor was warning him. The boy listened intently for a moment. Then he faintly heard the beat of approaching hoofs. Dan couldn't see the approaching riders, but he knew they were not the Lone Ranger and Tonto, who had gone down trail. Dan acted quickly.
Come along, Victor.
Leading Victor, the boy moved to where his blanket was lying. Then, picking it up, he went on with his horse into a narrow gully, the edges of which were lined with thick brush.
Oh, Victor, hold on. Whoever passes by can't see us down here. We'll be able to watch them. Be quiet, fella.
Hey, look, Bill. Like somebody might have been camping along here.
That sure does wish he would have.
Oh, what are we stopping for?
My wrist is hurting again. Somebody was using this place for a campsite.
There
must
be
water nearby.
Yeah, easy. That's right. Hey, you know, Mel, whoever was here hasn't been going long either. The embers of this campfire are still glowing.
Look beyond it. I mean to. A couple of blankets and stuff. That means they're aiming to get back here, Bushy. Let's find the water and clean this wound on my wrist. You keep your eyes peeled while I fill it.
Nobody'd know you without the white mask on, Mel. Hey, the small stream over to the left. Come on.
Yeah.
Golly, they must be two of the crooks.
That feels better. Let's get back to the horses.
How about taking those blankets and supplies with us, Mel? We can use them.
Forget it. No use letting folks know we stopped here. You ought to know better than that. Let's be on our way.
As the two gunmen moved toward their horses, Dan's horse Victor shifted position uneasily, and his hoof came down upon a dry twig with a loud snap.
Easy, Victor.
Hey, Mel, you hear that?
Hear what?
I heard a noise like somebody stepping on a dry branch or something. Came from back yonder.
Maybe somebody's in that gully back there. We're pointing our guns that way. If anybody's in that gully, you better come out and quick.
I'll just keep quiet.
Come on, Mel. Let's walk back there and have a look.
Quiet, Victor.
Hey, Mel. There is someone in that gully. Duck for cover and start throwing bullets.
No, wait. Don't shoot. I haven't a gun.
Sounds like a youngster. You there. Come out of that gully with your hands raised. Come on.
I'm coming out. Come on.
Realizing that he had no chance of escape in the face of possible bullets from the two crooks' guns, Dan Reed decided to face them and try to talk his way out of trouble. Leading Victor, he climbed the low bank and walked toward the gunman.
Oh, Victor, steady.
All right, Jiminy, it's a boy. What were you doing down in that gully, youngster?
Well, I was camping here with two friends. They rode toward town, but I was tired, so I rolled into my blanket. When I heard your hoofbeats coming down the trail and turning in here, I thought I'd better hide.
What were you scared of? How'd you know it wasn't those friends of yours coming back?
Well, they rode the other way. Of course, now that I've talked to you, I'm sure I have nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah? What makes you think so?
Well, you didn't try to steal anything from our camp.
You were watching plenty close, weren't you, bud?
The moon is very bright tonight, and I could see plainly.
And since you were right there watching from the gully, you must have been able to hear plainly, too, huh?
Hey, Mel, if this youngster did hear what we said and told...
Just what did you hear, Button? Come on, speak up.
I didn't pay much attention, and you really didn't talk much.
I asked you what you heard. You gonna tell me the truth, or do I have to beat it out of you? Speak up before I lose my temper.
You're hurting me. Let go. If I were older, you wouldn't do that.
Tell us what you heard. Go on.
You said you wanted to clean your wounded wrist.
What else did you hear?
He said to take blankets and supplies, but you told him to forget it.
Now, look, Mel, if he heard that much, he heard what was said about nobody knowing you without the white mask.
You heard that too, didn't you, Button?
Yes, but it doesn't mean anything to me.
Maybe the boy's all right, Bushy.
And maybe he isn't, Mel. Look at that horse. I remember seeing it hitched right outside the bank today, just before things began to happen. This button is playing dumb, that's all.
Boy, Thunder, I remember seeing that horse in town too, Bushy. That means this youngster was there at the time. In that case, he must have saw us leaving. Come on, speak up. You see what happened in town today? Answer me!
You bully!
He saw it all right.
Then you must have known we were connected with it when Bushy mentioned the white mask, didn't you?
No. Why should I?
If you were bigger, we'd plug you. Reckon you figured on spreading the news we stopped here as soon as we were out of sight.
The boy's wise to us. There's no doubt of that.
We ought to shoot him right now, Mel.
Turner! No use being hasty, Bushy. We'll take him along with us and decide what to do with him after we reach our hideout camp. Get on your horse, Butner. I might change my mind and put slugs in both you and that horse of yours. Go on, hit leather. Be quick about it.
All right.
I have the bridle, Mel. Let's get to our horses.
Remember, youngster, I'm holding this gun on you, so don't try to get away.
Steady. Easy now.
Now start down the trail.
Come on.
Get it fast.
Get it. Get it.
About an hour after Dan had left with the two crooks, the Lone Ranger and Tonto returned to the camp.
Who's gone? Easy, oh, fella. Easy, fella.
Dan isn't here and Victor's gone.
Someone scatter campfire. Look, Kimasabi. He see footprints. Moon, plenty bright.
That's a man's footprint. Yes, and there's another.
Footprints go to gully back yonder.
Yes. Otto, here's Dan's blanket.
Dan may be hide here from someone. After, hoof marks and footprints go back up bank. We go look.
Come on. They stood here, Tonto.
Look. Look like Dan struggled here. Him skip.
Yes,
look. Scuff of ground. Wait, me find something here.
What is it?
It mask.
Yes, a white mask. The crook who wears a white mask must have been here with one of his men.
And them take Dan.
We'll pick up their trail right now, Tonto. We must find Dan before they harm him. Let's go.
Steady, big fella. Easy, Scout.
Hey, Silver!
Up, Scout!
The gunmen, Mel and Bushy, took Dan Reed several miles from the campsite of the Lone Ranger. They turned off the trail and covered their hoof marks in the stream for some distance. Then, leaving the water where the bank was hard and rocky, they headed for a small farmhouse.
Come on, get up there!
Come on! Yeah.
Riding for several minutes.
There, Bushy. There's our hideout.
Yeah, I reckon the others are there by now.
Golly, the sheriff wouldn't think of looking there for a gang of crooks.
That's your general idea, Button. We all act as farmhands for the widow Tandy. Nobody suspects.
Who there?
Hold it.
There, put the horses in the barn with the others, Bushy. I'll take this youngster inside.
You all right? Come on.
All right, come on, you.
Man, you had me downright worried.
Yeah.
The others came home long ago. They're out in the bunkhouse. Say, who's the boy, and why'd you bring him here?
This youngster got wise to us with a nabby, so we brought him along. We'll tie him up and keep him here until we find out all about him.
You and Bushy are a couple of fools.
Yep.
This boy'll be both a nuisance and a danger to all of us. You must have friends who'll be looking for him.
I'll have one of our men go to town and find out if anyone's asking about the boy. Meantime, we'll try to get more information from him. We'll be leaving here in a few days anyway, and then we'll get rid of the Button.
I don't like having him around, Mel. It's risky.
Well, it's either that or do away with him right now. That's for you to decide. Now, which is it to be?
The curtain falls on the first act of our Lone Ranger adventure. Before the next exciting scenes, please permit us to pause for just a few moments. Stood a moment staring at Dan Reed. Then she spoke.
I don't like having him around, but it goes against the grain to have to kill a youngster.
Here comes Juan.
So, this must be the boy Bushy told me about when he brought the horses to the barn.
That's right.
What's your name, son?
My name is Dan Reed.
Dan, huh? Tell us what you know about all this. How did you find out about Mel and Bushy? Who else knows?
I can't tell you anything, ma'am. They forced me to come here with them, that's all.
No use bothering with a button now. Juan, take him out to the barn and tie him up. We'll get plenty of information out of him later.
Yeah, take him, Juan, and make sure you bind him tightly. He mustn't get away from here.
He will not get away. I shall see to that.
Good. Get him out of here now. The others will be turning in soon to get some sleep.
See, I tie him tight and put him on some straw out in the barn. Come along, my friend.
Meantime, the Lone Ranger and Tonto followed the trail of the two crooks who had taken Dan with them. Though the moon shone brightly, it was slow work. And when they finally reached the point where the hoof marks entered the stream, the two men drew rein.
Oh, fella.
They entered the stream here to cover their trail, Toto.
Ah. It not good, Dan, with killers like them.
Toto, they harm Dan. I'll never stop them.
Now, quick. Easy, fella. Shots come from over rise, just ahead.
Yes. We'll lead the horses back into that thick grove. The trees will give us some protection. Come, Silver. Come, boy.
Come, fella.
The shadows hide us from them now. The crooks might have doubled back and waited in ambush in case they were followed. Stay here, Toto.
See anyone?
No. They're in shadows too, so I can't.
Come out in there with your hands up. I have a posse with me and we'll get it anyhow.
The sheriff and the posse.
That's not good.
They'll not return their fire, Toto. We can't let them capture us.
Not right.
If you aren't coming out, we're coming after you right now.
Quick, let's mount. We ride to the trees and try to lose them easy. Send me, fella.
Come easy, fella.
Come, send
them. Get them out, come.
After leaving the grove, the masked man and Indian rode at top speed for some time to outdistance their followers. Then, after using various means to cover their tracks, they came to a halt.
Evidently, the sheriff and the posse were ready to shoot first and ask questions afterwards, Toto.
Good it not daytime. Them think maybe we belong to gang of crooks who robbed bank at Rock Point. It not easy to explain to sheriff.
No, not when I'm wearing this mask.
Them not follow us now.
I'm sure we've lost them. We've also lost valuable time in our search for Dan. They go back to that stream and try to pick up the trail again.
Not a good idea.
Monsilver!
Get him up, scum!
During the rest of the night, the Lone Ranger and Tonto searched along the riverbank for some sign of the crooks and Dan Reed, but were not able to pick up the trail again. Worried and discouraged, the masked man called a halt
taking time out to camp along the water's edge to rest the horses. Meanwhile, Dan Reed, tied hand and foot in the barn at the hideout, had passed a sleepless night. At dawn, Juan brought a small amount of food and untied Dan's bonds. After eating, Dan was forced to help groom and saddle the horses.
You've done well. Only once have I had to slap you so far.
I've done it only because I'm forced to.
But I warn you, watch your tongue so I do not lose my temper. Now I must tie you again.
You're a bully, too. If I were bigger, I'd knock your block off.
There. Perhaps the widow Danby will bring you some lunch and feed it to you.
She's as bad as the rest of you.
See, but for such an old senora, she is very smart. Now I take the horses out. Adios.
After Juan left with the horses, locking the barn door behind him, Dan, tightly bound, lay for some time trying to think of a plan to escape. He waited until he heard the crooks ride away from the farm. Dan waited for about 10 minutes. Then he decided to try a plan he'd thought of. He called out to his horse, Victor, who was tied in a stall at the back of the barn.
Victor! Victor, come here! Here, Victor!
Hearing his young master's voice calling, Victor pulled and tugged at the rope that held him. Then the intelligent horse started gnawing at the tie line. Finally, the rope was frayed enough to break, and with a whinny of triumph, Victor came to Dan's side.
Good boy, Victor. Here, fellow. Gnaw these ropes. Get me loose, Victor. Gnaw them.
Dan rolled over and held his bound wrists toward Victor. The horse sniffed a moment, then getting the idea, tried to gnaw the rawhide strips. Over and over, he tried to loosen the knots, but the rawhide became wet and the knots tightened.
It's no use, Victor.
At that moment, Dan had another idea.
Go, Victor. Go back to camp. Get the Lone Ranger. Go, Victor. Kick, Victor. Kick, fella, kick. You did it. Good boy, Victor. Go get the Lone Ranger. Go to the camp.
Inside the farmhouse, the widow Danby and one of the crooks who had stayed behind when the others left went hurriedly to the barn when they heard the racket.
Maybe the boy managed to get away somehow.
Oh, there he is, still tied hand and foot.
Hey, the barn door is smashed. You, Dan, tell us what happened out here.
My horse didn't like being tied in a strange stall. He gnawed his tie line and kicked his way out through the barn door, then he ran away.
Well, since the boy didn't get away, I don't reckon it matters much.
Mel's not gonna like it when he comes back. Juan should have seen to it that the horse was put into a box stall.
Oh, what's the difference? If he did get away, he'll stop to graze before he gets very far.
Maybe it doesn't make any difference. Mel and the boys will be back soon, then we'll find out what they think. Let's get back to the house. Come on.
Meantime, the Lone Ranger and Tonto again made ready to search for Dan. Before mounting, they stood on the bank of the stream, looking first one way, then the other.
The opposite bank is all shale and rock, Tonto. Beyond that are the foothills. The only buildings for miles are the farmhouse and outbuildings of the widow Danby's place back in the hills.
Hideout of crooks must be on that side stream, Kimatabe.
Yet we've been up and downstream for some distance without finding the marks where they left the water.
That's right. Maybe if we... Listen, Kimatabe.
What do you hear?
Me hear hoofbeats coming down other side stream.
I don't hear anything. Perhaps you... Yes, I hear them now. Sounds like one horse traveling fast.
Look! It's Victor! Run along stream another side.
Victor! Victor, here! Oh, Victor, over! Oh! Come here, Victor! Come over here!
I him see us. Him gonna cross stream.
Good boy, Victor. He's heading back toward camp, Tonto.
Him come along another side. We go over now and backtrack Victor's trail?
Yes, let's hurry. Easy, Sidney.
Easy, Scout. Easy,
Paul.
Get off the tower. Come, Victor.
Lone Ranger and Tonto rode back along the bank of the stream in the direction from which Victor had come. Finally, they found his tracks in the earth beyond the shale and rock. The tracks led into the hills, and the two men could easily follow them. Before long, they came to the top of a ridge and stopped among the trees.
Look down there, Tonto. That's where the Widow Danby lives. The barn is between us and the house.
Victor's tracks lead down, back a barn.
We'll leave the horses here among the trees and go down there on foot. We move cautiously and have our guns ready. All right, let's go.
Still following the tracks left by Victor, the masked man and Indian carefully moved down the tree-studded slope behind the barn. A few moments later, they both moved quickly into the barn.
Then...
Am I glad to see you? Victor did find you.
Isn't that right? Here, me untie you,
Dan. Are you all right, Dan?
Yes, sir. The crook who wears a white mask and his gang stay here. Old Widow Danby is in with them. They work here as our farm hands when they aren't robbing and killing people.
Oh, how many are there?
I counted six men, sir. Five of them rode away this morning. The other one is inside the house with a widow.
Now you're free.
Thanks a lot.
Dan, Victor's in a grove behind the barn. Call up there through the bushes, then ride down over the hill so they'll not see you. Go to town and ask the sheriff to bring his men here. Tell him what you found out.
Yes, sir.
And what we do?
We'll hide in the hayloft. I think their crooks will come here when they're told about Dan and the horse being gone. Then we'll go into action.
Later, the crooks returned to the house and heard from the widow about Victor's escape. Juan went to the barn to put up the horses. A few moments later, he entered the house excitedly.
Senors, the boy is gone.
How did he get away?
I don't know, but he is gone.
Someone must have untied him. Let's go out and look around. Come on, fellas.
There. See for yourselves, senors.
He was here a while ago. I came out with Joe when his horse got away.
That's right, and he was tied up tight.
That means the dirty little sneak is on foot. We'll get our horses spread out and find him. Whoever sees him first, put a bullet in him. Let's go.
Who
said that?
Look, up in the hayloft. A masked hombre and an Indian, and they have guns.
They cover men. Get him down.
Hold it.
My leg.
He shot me. Gun him. Use your guns, all of you, and get them both.
Better drop your guns and forget what the widow said.
And the sheriff, he has a posse with him.
Don't give up. Fight your way out, man.
Drop your guns or we'll throw that. Drop them.
See, I dropped mine.
We'll come down now.
Look, Sheriff, he's wearing a mask. He and the Indian must be in with him.
I have them both covered.
Wait, Sheriff. Those are the friends I told you about. The ones who sent me to bring you.
That's right, Sheriff.
The tall crook called Mel is the masked killer. The widow works with the gang.
If Mel hadn't been stupid enough to bring that ornery boy here, you'd never have suspected us. Anyway, who does that masked man think he is running around with his face covered?
It doesn't matter to you, Widow Danby. Now that the white masked killer and his men are caught, our work in this territory is done. We'll leave them in your custody, Sheriff. Come, Dan, Tonto. Adios, all.
Goodbye.
Say, are you gonna let that masked hombre just walk out?
Go ahead. Tell her who that masked man is, Sheriff.
Yeah. You see, Widow Danby, that hombre wearing the black mask is on the side of the law. It might surprise you plenty to know that he's the Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger?
Thank you. is a feature of the Lone Ranger Incorporated, created by George W. Trendle, produced by Trendle Campbell Enterprises, directed by Charles D. Livingston, and edited by Fran Stryker. The part of the Lone Ranger is played by Brace Beamer.
That was The Lone Ranger, January 25th, 1952, on Welcome Visitors. Don't quote me on this, but I think that the one who's playing Dan Reed in this particular episode is Casey Kasem. But then again, I could be wrong. This is about going to wrap it up for my half of Michael Saturday Surprise for this Saturday. Hope you guys have enjoyed this show as much as I've enjoyed playing it for you guys. Let me turn things over to Luis so that he can put the finishing touches on tonight's presentation. Luis, my friend, come and tell these people how to post complaints, comments, grievances, questions, requests, anything else that may be on their minds.
All right, Mike. Great work as usual, man. And I guess it's time for me to wrap things up for here tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, that is just about going to do it for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry. If you want to come back and join us next week, there will be more OTR surprises waiting for your listening enjoyment. If there's anything you need to say about tonight's program, any comments, questions, complaints, maybe you have some ideas, we'd love to hear them, so please address them via email to mikeameli@earthlink.net. That's MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We'll soon be releasing the key and turning over the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.